Good morning. I'd like to call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Tuesday, April 10th, 2018. The time is 9:14 a.m. If you're joining us off net or online, we're in Juneau, Alaska, the state capital, on the fifth floor in Senate Finance. I'm Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. With me this morning, Co-Chairman Hoffman.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Vice Chairman Bishop.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Machicki. Senator Machicki should be joining us shortly. He's away on other state business at this moment. Senator Von Imhoff.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Is there anything to come before the committee before I begin? I'd just like to remind everyone today that floor session starts at 10:45. We have a joint meeting with the House for confirmations later this morning. On today's agenda, we have SB 216, School Funding for Consolidations of Schools, SB 157, Microloan Revolving Fund and Loans, and SB 186, Voter Registration and PFD Application Registration. The first item on today's agenda is SB 216. A brief history: on April 2nd and April 5th, we heard this bill. The public hearing was opened and closed, and we reviewed the fiscal notes. There were questions, I believe, from Senator Stevens regarding if districts could manipulate in any way the bill that's before us to increase either funding to them or cost to the state. I'd like to invite Jonathan King, staff to Senator Von Imhoff, to the microphone, as well as Brittany Hartman, if she would like. Jonathan, I think you've got it. It's fine. Mr. King, do you have comments for the committee's consideration on the CS for Senate Bill 216/T?
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jonathan King. I'd just like to give you a brief review of the purpose of SB 216. The purpose is to promote the efficient use of Alaska's existing K-12 education infrastructure. As you know, Section 1 removes the disincentive created by Alaska's school size factor for districts with multiple schools in the same community to consider voluntary school consolidation, and it creates a four-year funding transition for consolidating schools. This section does not change Alaska's school funding formula in AS 1417-450. It does not affect funding for districts that choose not to consolidate schools. It does not affect funding for non-consolidating schools and districts which choose to consolidate other schools. It does not add or subtract from a district's ability to a pre-existing ability to consolidate. It does not affect the existing hold harmless, which schools can already take advantage of in the case of rapid student loss. That's in AS 1417-410-B1E. And it does not affect the state's contribution to student transportation aid contained in AS 1409-910, as that is based on unadjusted ADM, and this bill does not affect unadjusted ADM. Section 2 corrects an unintended consequence of AS 1417-905, where rural K-12 schools lost funding above 425 ADM, thus creating the potential incentive to build a second school. The changes in Section 2 would allow a single community, single school K-12 facility to receive funding above 425 ADM as they do at or below 425 ADM. And that, Madam Chairman, is a short summary of SB 216 and the purpose.
Thank you. Are there questions from committee members? I had a question, Mr. King, and I'd like the Department of Education and Early Development to put it on the record. I had a question that was triggered by comments from Senator Stevens regarding the possible use of districts consolidating and then the state having to pick up additional costs on transportation, whether they were flying folks to a regional school or whether they were having to use boats to cross rivers and setting up a new structure. Heidi Tishner, are you in the room? Would you be the most appropriate to answer that question on the record for me? Mr. Elwin Blackwell also, do we have a, thank you, Mr. King.
Good morning. For the record, Heidi Teschner, Director of Finance and Support Services with the Department of Education and Early Development. Chair McKinnon, in response to your question regarding the transportation, the formula program for pupil transportation as currently set in statute is a block grant. And as long as the per pupil student amounts that are currently set in statute do not change, there will be no increase to the state under the pupil transportation program. Districts, however, may see an increase in their cost for pupil transportation if they have an increase in a route that is probably potentially tied to their contract. But as I stated, it won't increase the state grant at this time.
Mr. Blackwell, do you have a comments for the committee?
No, I don't.
Thank you. Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question on the fiscal note. Is that okay?
Could we finish this answer and then move to the fiscal note?
Yes.
So I'm in receipt of an email to my staff from Marcy Herman to Brittany Hartman, who is carrying SB 216 or assisting with the carrying from Senate Finance. And in it, it says the total pupil transportation program as it runs through deed under AS 1409010 will not increase under SB 216 because it is based on ADM, brick and mortar, not adjusted ADM. If a school is closing and consolidating with another school, then ADM would not change. As long as the per pupil amount currently set in statute do not change, the overall grant program and payment to school districts will not change. With that said, school districts could potentially see increases in their transportation costs if they have an increase in the number of routes they serve as a result of the consolidation of schools. Routes are determined by school districts, and contract costs may be influenced by the number of routes served. These increases in transportation costs should be analyzed by the school districts when considering consolidation and should be offset by a savings as a result of the consolidation of schools. Is that accurate?
Madam Chair, yes.
So the state is not going to be responsible for any decisions that the districts make or the financing required if transportations go up for individual schools. Ms. Teschner.
That's correct.
Thank you. Senator Machicki, could we move to the fiscal note?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering why after year four, this bill actually saves the state some level of funding, which I don't see as being adequately reflected in the fiscal note. Is there a reason for that, or is it just save an indeterminate since we don't know who's going to take advantage of the program and what the actual savings may be?
Ms. Tischner?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki. In the numbers section of the fiscal note, you are correct that there's no savings shown. On page 3 of the fiscal note, in that first paragraph after the bulleted stars, we tried to explain why it's not reflected in here, and it is because we don't know which schools are going to be consolidating in order to determine what kind of savings that would bring to the state.
Senator Machicki, I think you rightly point out for the general public who's following this that we have a fiscal note that has some cost to it, but another that does not reflect the savings that are intended. So there's no increased funding coming from the state level to support the ADM in this bill. But what it does do is if it is a district decision is to allow consolidation and then a step down of to the current existing state statutes. Senator Von Imhoff, do you want to speak to that at all? Thank you for pointing that out, Senator Machicki. Other questions from committee members? Thank you for joining us in Senate Finance today.
Thank you.
Are we ready to move the bill? Senator Bishop, anyway, we have a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move committee substitute for Senate Bill 216, version 30-LS1483/Tango from committee with the accompanying fiscal notes and committee recommendations.
Is there objection? Seeing and hearing none, the CS for Senate Bill number 216, finance, / T, moves from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual committee recommendations. Brief at ease while we sign the paperwork. Good morning. Still Senate Finance, still April 10th, 2018. The next bill before the Senate Finance Committee is Senate Bill 157, an act relating to the Alaska Microloan Revolving Fund and loan from the fund. I'd like to invite Brittany Chowney, thank you, Haywood, the Director of the Division of Economic Development, to the table to present the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the committee for having us today. For the record, my name is Brittany Chowney Haywood. I'm the Director of the Division of Economic Development in the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. And today I'm here to talk about SB 157 that amends the Alaska Microloan Revolving Loan Fund. For some quick background, the purpose of the Microloan Fund is to promote economic development in Alaska by assisting small and micro businesses that may not have access to traditional financing. This access to badly needed capital will facilitate startup expansion, job creation throughout Alaska with specific policy emphasis on rural communities. New businesses are responsible for 80% of all new jobs created in the U.S., and by finding ways to support and incentivize new business growth, the state can start to fill some of the economic gap that's being created in the downturn in the economy from the oil industry and reduced state spending. Small-scale startups and businesses have difficulty securing funding, especially if they do not fit the profile of a high-growth potential business. Having an effective microloan program then focuses on these so-called lifestyle businesses, particularly those owned by rural Alaskans, immigrant entrepreneurs, and minorities, and then they could unlock a large number of new businesses that could serve as economic anchors in their communities. The Alaska Micro Revolving Loan Fund was created by the legislature in 2012. The loans may be made for working capital, equipment, construction, or other commercial purposes for Alaska-owned and operated businesses. The applicant must be an Alaska resident for the 12 months preceding the date of application, and the loans may not be made to pay costs that were incurred more than 6 months before the loan application was submitted. The terms and conditions of the loan, as currently authorized, do not provide enough flexibility to allow micro businesses with limited cash flow to take advantage of this opportunity that the program provides. The legislature has asked us in the past to make sure that our loan funds are being effective, so this is one way we ensure that, is that we believe these changes are needed. The terms of the loan is one of these ways in which we can incentivize small business and micro businesses to take entrepreneurial risks that help create Alaskan jobs through small business enterprise. The proposed changes this bill makes will help facilitate growth in this sector. Once a business is established and growing, it can then avail itself to private sector financing, further contributing to our economy. The bill changes is that it corrects a lower tier for the bank denial from $34,999 to $35,000 even. It increases the maximum loan term from 6 years to 15 years, and it increases the interest rate calculation by 1 percentage point. That's a quick overview, Madam Chair, of the program, and I would be happy to answer any questions that you or the committee has.
Thank you for those comments. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is a very fine program from what I've seen of it, but I think it's worthwhile getting on the record the default rate, what has been your experience in the past with these loans. I think it's fairly minimal, but it would be nice to know exactly.
Sure, of course. Through the Chair, Senator Stevens, we currently have one loan that is in default. That's at a 6% rate. But we've only had about 14 loans made out of the loan fund, so it sounds higher than it really is. It's one loan. It's for just over $11,000, and we are currently working with the borrower to do a modification and bring that loan back into compliance.
If Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Why are we giving a listing a fixed rate instead of points above prime?
It's 2 percentage points above prime.
Okay, I'm just reading this. Okay, thank you.
Senator Machicki, followed by Senator Bishop.
Actually, just the substantive changes are 3, and I think so you went with 2% to account for the longer term from 6 to 15 years, it looks like to me, but you also adjusted, you didn't mention on the record, I didn't hear it on the record that you dropped the interest rate, and that's just simply the minimum at 4%. It's just because interest rates are lower than when this bill was originally put across the finish line. Is that correct?
Ms. Gioni Haywood.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki. So that is true. We have changed the floor amounts from 4% to 4% and 8%. So the floor of 4%, a ceiling of 8%. The interest rate calculation, yes, is 2 percentage points versus 1 percentage point on prime. And the part of the reason is that it would bring us, it would allow us to account for some additional risk that we might take with that longer term. It also brings those percentage or those interest rates more in line with all of our other programs as well.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Thank you. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The previous speaker got one of my questions answered. Thank you. The fund capitalization, what's your balance that, and how many loans do you typically see in a year, applications?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, so the fund balance, I'll start with that, the cash available to lend is just under $2.3 million. We currently have 14 loans. We had 33 applications. We've approved 14 loans.
Thank you.
The I guess if you break that out over the last 6 years, that's about 2 loans a year. Again, we think that a lot of times borrowers will come in, but when we amortize those payments out over just 6 years, they're unwilling to take on that debt risk. And a lot of businesses are obviously, particularly when they're small, very risk averse. And so we believe that extending this term would allow for more flexibility in those payments.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a significant number of questions, and I don't necessarily think that I can ask them all now, but would like permission to kind of list them all out and through an email of some sort.
Certainly putting some of them on the record today would be helpful so that the committee knows the direction that we're going. I know for myself, how long has the program been in effect? How much money was originally given to the program? The average interest rate that you're doing, the average payments that folks are making, are they investing in particular? What kind of businesses are they investing in? Senator Von Imhoff, others?
Yes, those are all my questions as well. What is the maximum amount lended to any individual? What is the credit evaluation process by which you evaluate applications? Within the application, does it also include a business plan? And to what degree do you analyze credit report and credit rating or lack thereof? My last comment is that I do feel that 15 years is quite a long time. 6 years is a short time. I'm thinking a sweet spot might be somewhere in between then. Having a credit and banking background, 15 years for a small business is quite a long time. I'm also interested in what kind of collateralization these loans have. And I think that's the making a note of it, prime right now, as of this week, is 4.75%. So if it was prime plus 2, the loans would be closing at 6.75, just for the record. I don't know how often you adjust the rates, monthly, every 6 months, every quarter, you know, because prime adjusts itself. And then if it reaches 8%, you just leave it there in case prime goes up high. You'll just keep it at 8 and it'll be fixed, I take it, until prime falls. So those are my thoughts. Thank you.
Senator Machicki.
And I just have a quick one. You socialize the risk by extending the availability of a term. Did you consider a slotted risk? So where you maybe stayed at 6 years and under at a lower rate and 6 years and over at the higher rate? Like I said, I mean, I probably don't need to explain socializing the risk, but it is what occurred by making a longer term available and increasing the point above prime by one.
Sure. Ms. Chione Haywood.
Thank you. Madam Chair, if I could address Senator Machicki's question first. I have a number of responses I could do to the list, or if it's preferred, we can go through those via email.
Senator Machicki.
Madam Chair, I have been beckoned, I'm okay with it being on the response that you all have asked for on some of the other information. I served on the Kenai Peninsula Economic Development District Board, so I'm well aware of how this program functions, but just wanted to understand why they made the change and decided to charge everyone the higher rate.
Thank you, Senator Machicki.
So through the chair,
please go ahead.
Senator Machicki's question. We're looking at, again, we've been asked to make sure that these programs that we have under purview are effective. We've noticed that one of the things with this one is that we haven't seen the demand we would like to see over the last 6 years or so. Again, it's a newer program. They often take some time to get off the ground, but we were looking as a way to incentivize this and for the state to have that patient capital. We did not consider having kind of a stepped up interest rate or something along those lines. We were looking for increased flexibility in the term. It does not mean that we would make all of our loans at 15 years. The loan will be, we have a number of very experienced loan officers that do the underwriting and the looking at the collateral and working with the business owner or the, you know, prospective borrower in these loan funds. So the collateralization piece is done in that process where we look and make sure that we are collateralized properly for these loans. We have a long history of working with kind of unconventional borrowers in this loan program, our largest being to commercial fishing. The 15 years, again, was a request for flexibility. We have other programs that we work with that have terms that are that lengthy. We do look at credit. We run through Equifax and other ones that we look at credit ratings and reports. In addition to that, though, we also look at other options with those borrowers and their history. We do ask for business plans oftentimes and analyze those and information. There is, in addition to that, an application that the borrower is required to fill out. If the information is complete, we do go back and forth with the borrower until we have sufficient information on which to approve or deny that that application. The maximum to a single individual would be $35,000 without a bank denial. I believe if there's two individuals and or a bank denial, then we can go to $70,000. As for the kinds of businesses that have utilized the program, a little list. So some of the loan purposes that have been used at this point is insulating a seafood processing facility, sightseeing vessel, so a preseason startup capital loan, the purchase of a boat trailer for a startup charter business. There was an aircraft engine overhaul and interior refurbishment, remodel of a bed and breakfast for a new startup. There was a printer for a commercial photographer, other vessel refurbishments, commercial kitchen equipment. So it's kind of across the board and varied in the types of business that are applying for these types of loans. If we're looking at average payments and interest over the life of the program, I will have to go back and have that in a written response because I'll need to look that up. And I believe that the initial funding for this was $3 million. I will confirm that in my written response. Oh, and the interest rate is adjusted quarterly.
Senator Von Imhoff, follow.
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'd just like to speak in favor of this entire program. It's a very small amount we're loaning out to us, but to these businesses, they can make a world of difference. And looking through the projects you've done, boat trailers, engines, kitchen equipment, remodel for B&B, it seems to me the last thing we want to do is make it more difficult and discourage people from taking out these loans. To have a default of 1 out of 14 is pretty remarkable, it seems to me. And the information you're gathering, I'd like to know a little bit more about the success of those folks who have taken out loans. Has it made a difference in their business? Have they been successful? It should be nice to know how the program has worked.
Other questions from committee members? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In looking at the program and having been in business myself, I can understand where Senator Stevens is coming from because it is important to have capital out there. Without that, you're kind of boxed into a corner. What I'd like to know, though, as you look at it from an overall standpoint, we as the Finance Committee for the Senate, which has to do with the state's money, this program was created back in 2012, back when we were just coming off a lot of money and we had a lot of money in our coffers, and we were trying to go ahead and extend that benefit out to the business people that were starting up out there. But as you look at the costs that are related to this, the cost-benefit ratio of administering a program like this, the cost of having an oversight by the department that's there, I'm assuming it's not operating in the black as you look at the overall cost of everything. You only get two loans a year, which if you had a bank that had two loans a year, I think they would have difficulty with their shareholders and trying to justify that. I guess my question has to do with, can the state continue to afford to have a program like this now that we've got dealing with a $2 billion deficit and trying to go ahead and shore up our expenditures that are out there?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, this is a smaller loan program or revolving loan fund for us. The vast majority of our work comes off of the Commercial Fishing Revolving Loan Fund, and we are self-sufficient through our loan funds, through the interest and the fees that are charged. We pay for our operating expenses, and that is done by we break out basically a mixed ratio as to what activities occur on the loan funds. And so most of ours gets charged to commercial fishing or those other programs that are more active.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Just to make it clear then, you say that the state does operate somewhat in the black, or it's a benefit from the cost-benefit ratio to have this fund from the oversight of the state's position.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I would have to do some more analysis on this fund. In particular, again, it hasn't been very effective, which is why I'm before you today. As far as the other loan funds, we have worked and grown those over the years. Now, those are much longer in existence, 40-plus years. And so, but over that time, those funds have grown.
No further questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Van Imhoff.
Thank you. So when a applicant comes to your department, and I'm assuming that you ask for a bank decline letter, do you go any farther with the bank decline letter other than you simply got declined, or do you actually look into the bank of why they were declined and then determine why the bank won't lend them but why you overlook those reasons and why you're okay with lending them the money but the bank is not?
Through the chair, Senator Van Imhoff, the bank denial letters must list a valid reason. If not, then they're sent back to get that. Or potentially we might contact the bank ourselves. Most likely we'd ask for that information. Lending to individuals that have been turned down or may not be eligible for traditional financing does increase the risk of the portfolio overall. However, the division throughout its term has been lending to oftentimes non-standard borrowers. And so, and again, that's been for 40 plus years, having that staff that has worked with them and looking at other information from them is standard practice within the division. Oftentimes, the concerns of private financing isn't the same as the state. We do not have to be making a profit or have shareholders that we have to satisfy. We are looking to, again, service those funds well and be good stewards of the state's money, but beyond that, and serve our policy mission. But we don't have those additional criteria on us.
Senator Van Imhoff.
Thank you. Are there existing organizations right now that do cater to the higher risk borrower? So if a any one of these reasons, you know, refurb kitchen equipment or remodel a B&B, if they are denied by the bank, are there private businesses here in Alaska now that they could go to, albeit probably pay a higher rate and potentially a lower term, but is the state essentially competing against existing private businesses that do cater to this niche of a borrower?
Through the chair, Senator Van Imhoff, I would have to research that. There are, I know, other kind of NGOs, nonprofits that have similar programs, such as the Juneau Economic Development Council, but I would have to look into the for-profit model.
So if I could, I appreciate you presenting the bill. We would like to see a fact sheet around the inception, the money that was originally appropriated for the loan program, and many of the variables that have been discussed here today so that it could advance with the bill should we want to advance it so that you're not peppered with these same questions in other committees. So a fact sheet would be helpful to understand the program, the value, the beneficiaries of the loans. My question was on the life cycle of what we're loaning for. You did indicate that you have experienced loan operators. How many loan agents do you have?
Through Madam Chair, we have six, including the supervisor in Juneau, and three in Anchorage.
So nine loan officers.
Yes, that is correct. To service all 10 revolving loan funds.
Senator Van Imhoff.
That is basically one loan officer per loan.
Senator Van Imhoff, there are other loans inside of the other programs that she's talking about. This particular loan program has 14 loans in it over its life, which is valued at two, but some of the other loans have more activity. But certainly, this is not the first time we've had a loan program in front of us, which is why I asked a question on how many loan officers are in community and economic development. And so a larger a larger fact sheet would be good because we have other bills in our committee. We have a micro mariculture loan. So if we could get some kind of a sheet from the administration to get the larger view, which I think all of us are wondering, the cost of managing all of these loan programs as well as the benefit risk analysis for Alaska to be in the banking business. So we've sort of crept from some perspective into areas that may be competing with private organizations versus offering incentives for economic development, as you've said, to unconventional or non-standard borrowers. And so I think for the Finance Committee, specifically in the Senate, we would like to understand the suite of loan programs that you're offering, managing, and the overall effectiveness of how you're doing them and if it is the state's role to do that. Is that fair, Senator Von Imhoff?
That is exactly right.
Senator Michicki.
Just to clarify for the record, there are a number of revolving loan programs, and some of them have a lot higher value, many more loans at a much higher value. So that would be interesting. I think that might keep us from having something on the record that could be picked up that's outside of what really happens in the department. So I think that would be helpful, too, is describing the different loan programs. Just I have experience with this particular program. I just will tell you generally when the applicant comes to you, they've been through all the commercial options, and those options just are not available to them. Sometimes the loan is to supplement other funding that they have been able to secure. So it's I think that would help folks understand kind of what this particular program is about. But on the actual department, it would be nice to understand the portfolios they manage as well.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, ma'am. I'd just like to all good questions and comments by committee members, and I just my two cents on this. You know, this is kind of a one-off, you know, for on this microloan fund. But I'll just set the stage. You never know where someone will start in business and where they'll end up with a small loan. And a case in point is I'll leave nameless, but I'll just talk in kind of a bit of the abstract. Started with a two-cabin B&B, and today has invested over $187 million into Alaska's tourism industry, and who employs 50 people year-round, I mean not year-round but seasonal, in a certain borough, and contributes close to $200,000 in taxes to the local borough. So maybe it's somebody that starts out of some program like this. So,
thank you, Senator Bishop. Ms. Chione Haywood, are you in? Do you reside in Juneau, or do you reside in another area?
Madam Chair, I live in Juneau. Yes.
So it would be beneficial to the committee in considering a variety of loan programs that we have before us in committee right now, the higher perspective. And so, if you could work with my staff to put together some type of presentation, so we might see where the money is invested and balances and how it's managed, and whatever the department wants to bring to us, it needs to be fairly easy to digest. We're drawing near the end of session. I know that these programs are important to the people who are trying to access that money. I won't throw out any of the particular programs, but we have had some negative audits regarding some activities in some of these programs that are out there under your jurisdiction. And so that's not this one that's before us today, but we have had some auditing that's done by our auditors that have suggested some changes that, because of the political process, we've been unable to accomplish. And so it is important to understand the portfolio that we're managing, the costs of that management, and the value to the people of Alaska for those programs. With that, I'd like to, I don't think that we need to go, would the committee like a sectional analysis? It pretty much has been covered. There were three sections, and all three sections were spoken about today. Ms. Sione Haywood, thank you for joining us in Senate Finance today. We will try to have you back to us as quickly as possible. I'd like to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 157, an act relating to the Alaska Microloan Revolving Loan Fund and loans from the fund. Is there anyone wishing to testify? Mr. Anderson, I see that you're here and in the room for questions. Did you want to provide comments? Is there anyone waiting online? Public hearing is closed. Senator Bishop, are you ready to cover the fiscal note?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, appropriation is investments. The allocation is investments. The OMB component number is 383. The fiscal note analysis is zero. If this legislation were to pass, Riggs project would be required. The minimal costs associated with that can be absorbed by the current budgetary authorization.
Are there questions on the fiscal note? Seeing and hearing none, I'd like to know about any concerns on the program by noon tomorrow. We will be working with the sponsor to get information to you as soon as possible. We're moving into budget hearings starting this afternoon, so that will take up the majority of our day tomorrow. With that, I'd like to set this bill aside. Obviously, if you have concerns or questions, sooner is better than later. I just don't think that we'll be able to get it back up before tomorrow. The next item on the committee's agenda is Senate Bill 86, Voter Registration and Permanent Fund Dividend Application Registration. I'd like to invite Carol Thompson and Libby Bacalar. Libby is the Assistant Attorney General for the Department of Law. She will help us discuss the in and out version. And Ms. Thompson, if you could give us an overview of the bill in front of us, just the concepts that are.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carol Thompson. I'm the Absentee and Petition Manager for the Division of Elections. I'm going to do a brief overview of Senate Bill 186. The Division of Elections put forth legislation to harmonize the interaction between the Permanent Fund Dividend and the Division of Elections in relation to the automated voter registration law passed by ballot initiative in 2016. The 2016 ballot initiative required the Permanent Fund Division to provide elections with the PFD electronic data of applicants who met the eligible requirements for voter registration. Excuse me. Upon receipt of the electronic data, the division compares it with the voter registration database to target applicants considered as newly registered voters and those with an update to their registration record. Under this current law, the division is required to send by mail a notification to allow applicants an opportunity to opt out of voter registration. Applicants have up to 30 days to notify the division of their intention to opt out. If the opt-out notice is not received, then the division moves forth and processes the applications for registration accordingly. Our goal with legislation is to improve the experience of applicants registering to vote or updating their registration by providing the opportunity to opt out of voter registration at the time they apply for their PFD online or with a paper application. With this change, the division could leverage existing tools and procedures already in use for processing automatic voter registrations between the Division of Elections and the Division of Motor Vehicles. It would also allow the division to efficiently manage the program, process voter registrations in a more timely manner, as well as reduce state expenditures by eliminating the cost of sending an expensive mailing every year throughout the 30-day opt-out requirement. This is my brief overview. Thank you.
Thank you. So we have an initiative, for clarity, that passed voters. I personally know that there are multiple problems with implementation, at least, of that initiative. The bill before us has a opt-in provision.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Versus the opt-out from the initiative. Is it Ms. Bacalar?
Madam Chair, yes. For the record, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Libby Bacalar. I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the Department of Law. I'm here to answer questions of the committee on the opt-in versus opt-out amendment that was passed in the prior committee.
does this the bill before us meet the voter intent from the Department of Law's perspective?
Madam Chair, I believe it does not.
And could you speak to why you believe it does not?
Yes. Madam Chair, Article 11, Section 6 of the Alaska Constitution provides that an initiated law may be amended at any time, but may not be repealed by the legislature within 2 years of its effective date. What constitutes an amendment versus a repeal is a factual question that's been litigated a few times over the years in the Alaska Supreme Court, but the case law says that an amendment that vitiates the intent of an initiative will constitute an effective repeal of that measure. And it's our opinion that changing this initiative to be opt-in versus opt-out would be an unconstitutional overreach by the legislature to undo what the people by initiative enacted in 2016. Now, by 2019, the legislature could repeal this or change to an opt-out, but in this two-year time period, this automatic PFD voter registration opt-out was central to the ballot measure. So it's our opinion that we would have a constitutional problem with that amendment.
Ms. Bacalar, what happens if, because there is not consensus to be able to appropriately change state statute to reflect the voter intent, where does that place the legislature? If we cannot garner the support to do what the people have done through initiative, because they, one would think that they tried to do it through a regular process, I'm not sure, through the legislative process. I'm not sure that actually happened. In fact, I don't think it happened. This went straight to initiative versus having legislative conversation around this issue. And so there may be policymakers, I would be one of them, that believe there's a flaw in this, in the initiative that went forward, not on the opt-in or opt-out, just that the initiative, and I'll put it on the record because I have a different piece of legislation trying to do the opt-out provision for people who feel unsafe and feel like they're being stalked. So these bills are in our committee right now, and we have a voter initiative that wants to go one direction with the legislature, or at least one chamber of the legislature that may not have the votes to provide the underlying state statutes to accomplish the voter intention, possibly through valid reasons that were not explored by the folks who advanced the initiative.
So, Madam Chair, I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
What do we do if the legislature cannot pass the underpins that support the opt-out section of the initiative, which is central to why, at least it's purported as to why the initiative went forward?
Madam Chair, I think the legislature has discretion to amend the initiative in the ways that the division is proposing. To do a drastic change such as opt-out, or rather opt-in from opt-out, we think would be exceeding the legislature's constitutional authority at this point. If the legislature doesn't do anything on this initiative, I think the division would just continue to attempt to comply with it as best we can. It certainly is problematic to the division in the ways that this bill addresses. If those amendments, which we believe are constitutional amendments, can't be made, then I believe the division would simply continue to implement the law as is, as best we can.
So I'm not going to go through a sectional analysis today. What I'd like the committee to do is think about what is before us. We have voters who went to the polls and supported an initiative to register everyone through the permanent fund dividend application process. We have getting ready to go into the next ballot cycle, which is impending. It's approaching us fast, where all Alaskans' data are now going to be automatically registered based on what the division is doing in support of the voter initiative. So all that raw data is going to be available to the general public for consumption, and that data is going to be rich. That data has mailing addresses, sometimes email addresses and phone numbers, because everyone is automatically registered, which is why I brought this issue to you in the form of a different bill earlier. And I have met with the Division of Elections on their bill and my bill. Senator Michicki.
I was actually going to let it go, but since you called on me, Madam Chair, did the department challenge the constitutionality of forcing people to register to vote through the initiative process? I mean, I've just seen the initiatives. We may agree or disagree with the Lieutenant Governor on some of his objectives and decisions, we'll leave that out of the discussion. To me, it seems like there has to be a constitutional issue forcing someone who just believes that they're applying for one thing to automatically be forced to apply for another. I realize there's an opt-out, but many people are not aware of that option and just find themselves instantly registered with their information out there for the world to see.
Senator Michicki, through the chair, Article 11, Section 7 of the Alaska Constitution sets four limits on use of the initiative. Those limits are the dedication of revenue, the making and repealing of appropriations, rules of court, and local and special legislation. Those are the only four things that the people cannot, by initiative, enact. The Department of Law and the Lieutenant Governor's Office have to honor the case law precedent of the Alaska Supreme Court and what the Constitution says. We are not permitted prior to an election to keep measures off the ballot that do not violate those four restrictions.
Senator Michicki.
So therefore, the privacy section of our Constitution can be violated, and as long as it doesn't violate one of those four, that four-part test, it can violate other aspects of our Constitution?
So, Senator Michicki, there's a difference between a pre-election review and post-election review. Certainly constitutional challenges to an initiated law may be made after it's enacted. Prior to enactment, we may only look at Article 11, Section 7. That's the bar for certification of a ballot measure.
So a follow-up to Senator Michicki's line of questioning. The department is initiating compliance of the initiative through regulation. Can the challenge be made because you're initiating it, or do you have to wait for statutory statutory foundation before it can be challenged?
Madam Chair, certainly regulations can be challenged just like statutes can. In this particular instance, the things that the division is trying to accomplish in this bill can't be accomplished by regulation, specifically eliminating the cost of a very expensive mailer and having a more cooperative relationship with the Department of Revenue for the opt-out process. Those are things that can't happen through regulation. But certainly regulations can be challenged in court just like statutes. There's nothing that would stop somebody from being able to make a challenge to a regulation that the division adopted under the statute.
Senator Von Imhoff.
So this is an interesting conversation, Madam Chair. An unintended consequence of this initiative vote last year is public display of personal data, it appears to be. The question is, did people know, were they made aware of when they voted, that this could be an unintended consequence or this would be a natural consequence? It's hard to say. I don't really remember thinking about that when I voted for this, when I voted during that election. It's too late. The initiative passed. So what do we do now moving forward? I don't recall this year and during the PFD application that there was like a pop-up message or whatnot. By checking this box, your personal data will be given to the Division of Elections. I might have checked I agree, and the font might have been in 11 or 8 font. I don't know. But either way, I don't remember checking that box. Is there a way to... I'm going to pause because I think my thoughts are jumbled.
Senator Von Imhoff, right now, the bit, so that you're speaking to my bill a little bit, because we have two different bills that are addressing opt-in and opt-out. The bill before us is the, in its current form, is an opt-in to the program, which is in
It's an opt-out
of the program instead of an opt-in, which was the voter initiative. Thank you for that clarification. Still wrong.
No. Yes, Senator McKinnon, it's a, the bill itself was an opt-out. The current version is an opt-in. Yes.
Senator McKinnon, Madam Chair, the opt-in was changed by the amendment proffered by Senator Coghill in State Affairs, I believe. That was the substantive change that was made in the last committee.
A similar happenstance happened to my bill. just trying to throw some humor out here, gentlemen, which is why I asked the question, if we can't get to resolution, what happens for the people of Alaska? In the past, when I have not voted for an initiative, I'll give the example of commercialization of marijuana. It is still my job as the chairman of this committee to measure what we do by the law. The people have spoke. The people asked for an opt-out provision in the initiative that went forward, which is the measurement stick that we will use as we look at advancing a conversation at this table around this issue. In addition to that conversation is the issue about voter privacy and whether people actually realize that their, at this time their data is sold for $20. A $20 bill, I can't think of who's on that $20 bill at this moment, but Andrew Jackson. An Andrew Jackson will get you information to 300,000 names and addresses, possibly phone numbers and emails, to be used in any way that any individual who wants to bring Andrew to the state to exchange it for their data. And this is an issue for me that is different than this bill. Senator Von Imhoff.
So my understanding is of course, the PFD application is closed for 2018. We also have an election in 2018. So right now, all applicants for this year's PFD automatically opted in. You applied to vote when you applied for your PFD as of now. Is that correct?
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, I'm going to defer to Ms. Thompson on that question.
Through the chair, Senator, yes. So everybody through March of 31st of 2018 are part of the data pool that we will receive and that we will compare with our data system to determine if there are newly registered voters or if they are have an update, a significant update to the registration, and we'll be sending them the opt-out notice in the mail to them that they could complete and return back to us.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Okay, we'll get to that point. So this, the letter from Governor Walker says that the bill would make harmonizing amendments, this particular bill, governing record-sharing procedures from the Commissioner of the Department of Revenue to the Director of Division of Elections. So what harmonizing record exchange is there now?
Through the chair, senators, the harmonizing is basically we were able to get the data from the permanent fund. We are trying to work at it so that in the future when the applicant applies for their permanent fund, it is available at the front end when they're processing their application through the PFD. There'll be a notification that they can attest to, I realize I'm opting out, and confirm that prior to their information being transferred over to the division.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When, so the division's Department of Revenue has a treasure trove of data now that will be transferred over in some way to Division of Elections, mm-hmm. and then that will be made public when?
As soon as we complete data entry, and that typically at this point for, I'm sorry, through the chair, Senator. We are currently in the process of the 2018 period, and we are getting ready to send our first mailers out, and they will have 30 days to respond to that mailer, and then after the 30 days, then we begin doing data entry, so to speak, and putting them into our database system as registered voters. And then as soon as that's done, so that's a daily thing. So anybody can call and get that information and request voter lists.
Senator Von Imhoff.
You made one other, thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Are you sending out letters now for people to opt out? Are you sending out letters, and do they have 30 days at this point to say, oh, I applied for my PFD, and then now my data is going to be sold to the division or given to the Division of Elections, which will be available in this round of elections? I do not want to do that. I'm going to opt out. What are the options of someone to opt out now?
Madam Chair, Senator
Von Imhoff.
Yeah, Von Imhoff. I'm sorry. I'm just thinking, kind of composed my answer. Once we send out the notification, a person can either A, complete that card and send it back. They can call us up on the phone. They can send us an email. As soon as that happens, we will remove them from the list to be included into the voter registration.
For clarity, what Senator Von Imhoff was asking is what's okay. In the letter.
Oh, what is in the letter? I'm sorry. It basically states that we are... I do believe I have that here.
You weren't a registered voter, now you are.
Yeah, it's a notice of automatic voter registration is basically what the notice says. It says the information you provided on your permanent fund dividend application will be used to register you to vote unless you select the opt-out of this automatic voter registration process. And then it talks about if in order to be a qualified Alaskan voter, you must be a U.S. citizen, 18 years of age. And then there's a checkbox for them to check if they wish to opt out. And we ask that they provide an identifier and a signature and send it back to us.
Could we get a copy of that letter?
Absolutely.
Yes. That would be helpful.
And there's actually two types. There's one for a newly registered voter, and there is a type for a person with an update to, like, their residence address.
So if I might, the concern I have that we're trying to address in a different bill is the privacy issue, and those that have there may or may not be a reason for a person not to be registered. They could be new to the state and just been here a while, hadn't gotten involved in their community, and now are deciding that it's a good thing that they just were automatically registered and they didn't have to do anything else. There's maybe another individual or lots of different perspectives as to why people are choosing actively not to vote. In my community, one of those was that they were trying to protect themselves from the harassment of a family member that they did not want to engage law enforcement to keep them away from them. This is a concern for Lieutenant Governor Mallett. We have people who do not want their information made public, and this initiative has bypassed that process and, from their perspective, at least some, violated their rights to privacy. I'm not sure they're going to step out of into the limelight to challenge the state, but there could be drastic consequences if someone is a victim of stalking and has not chosen not to report, or that they are trying to get away from someone who has harmed them before. And we have not adequately responded to that I can see. Is there anything that you can provide me in reference to this bill and the letter that you're sending out, that it's somehow not going to just get thrown in the garbage and people aren't going to, it's just another piece of paper coming from state government?
Yeah, Madam Chair, that is correct. It's another piece of paper coming to the voter to give them that opportunity.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Madam Chair, along to Senator, the senator on my right got my question answered, and the senator on my left, I want to comment. So it takes a good team here to move things along. Okay, on your, Madam Chair, on your point of the trash going in the mail, has the Division of Elections considered not only, you know, you're going to notify people by mail to opt out, right?
Mm-hmm.
So their data can't be shared. But you also have, the administration also has other vehicles at your disposal to get the word out, and that's through the form of PSAs and et cetera, and I just wondered if you public service announcements, ma'am, I just wondered, you know, if you'd thought about a campaign to that effect where Lieutenant Governor goes on and drive time in the morning, and they hear it on the radio, and they get home at night, and, oh, here's my letter. So, anyway.
Through the chair, Senator, I can't recall what we did in 2017, but that's certainly something that we could do, PSAs and things of that nature, absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. For clarity, the letter, I believe, coming from the division is that you don't have to be a registered voter, and so your opt-out would be that you don't register to vote. Is that accurate, Ms. Thompson?
Madam Chair, that is correct. It allows you that opportunity to not register to vote.
Thank you. And the other bill that I have offered offers an ability to be able to vote but would blind the data so that you wouldn't have a mailing address or a physical address of it, and possibly a precinct number, your email, your phone numbers, that you could put up a no trespass sign on your own personal data, which is different than this. This is, I'm not going to vote. Mine is, I would like to vote, but I would like you not to share all my information. Senator Machicki.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I fundamentally disagree with a paper opt-out not going to the people of Alaska. I think there are many people that have no idea what, and I don't mean that they're uninformed. It sounds like a really good idea. I mean, I think a couple things are going to happen from the initiative. One is I believe that we're going to have the lowest voter turnout in the history of the United States because everyone's going to be registered. I'm not sure that that changes participation. It just registers you. But there are still many Alaskans, and I can tell you that I communicate with my constituents in many different ways. Some as social media, some as by email, and some are through the mail, because that's still, when I send them something in the mail, they respond. And I just think they have no other way of knowing for some demographics without getting something in the mail. And I don't believe that people throw things away that come from the state. I think they open them, they look at them, and they say, oh, my gosh, I had no idea that you registered me automatically when I filled out my PFD. I want to opt out. So I don't support that removal, and I just wanted to make that clear at this point. Unless someone has a compelling case for the people that only communicate by official things that come from the state in the mail, I think it's a mistake to remove it, and I don't believe it's a money savings. I believe there are some that worry that a lot of a high degree or a high proportion of people are going to opt out using that method and don't want them to. And I do want them to have that option.
For clarification, we were talking about that you were in the process of data entry. Is that accurate? From the permanent fund corporation application, that data entry is going into our system now?
Madam Chair, not yet. We are sending the mailer out this week of the first 89,000 voters, 89,000 plus. And then we have to wait 30 days to allow the voters time to be able to opt out under the law. And then we will begin data entry once we get any notifications back that we can select those voters and remove them from the data who have selected to opt out. Then we will begin data entry.
So we had to get their address from somewhere, and we've done a cross-check already. So we've got something on the voter before we send the information.
Madam Chair, we do get the permanent fund raw data, and we compare that with the voter registration data to come up with our pool of people that we are going to target.
But they won't be in the Division of Election database until the 30 days has elapsed. And some with mailing, I would assume you need to do more than 30. If you're giving them 30, then there's the Postal Service, so we shouldn't be starting data for closer to 40 days.
Madam Chair, it would range around, probably around 40 days is probably accurate by the time we get through, close out the period, and then move all those over into our system and get prepared to do data entry of those voter registrations.
And then a follow-up to that, then will you be deleting the names off of the list from the Permanent Fund Division, or what will happen to that data entry as you identify people who did not want to vote that was were intentionally asking you not to vote?
Madam Chair, we remove those as soon as we receive them. So it does not even go into the voter registration system. We remove them at the time. As soon as we get the notice, we flag that and we remove that.
So I'm sorry, Ms. Thompson, this is going to be a reoccurring problem every year, so people are going to have to file this piece of paperwork every year. Otherwise, they will be re-upped. You're not going to save the data to cross-check it. But
Madam Chair, that is correct. It would be every year.
So just identify another problem for folks that even if they send it in once, we're not saving the data. We're deleting it, and you will have to do it every year. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if you're at liberty, but if you can tell me what we're doing to what the Division of Elections and we as a state are doing to maybe enhance our security at the division, I'd appreciate it.
Through the chair, Senator, I would not be best to speak to those questions. I don't have extensive knowledge.
Senator Michicki.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm concerned with the constitutional changes that were made in this bill in the previous committee. I mean, I hear what the assistant AG is, I hope I said the title correctly, is saying, but I also see that changing the contact methods could also be regarded as a constitutional issue. And the reason for that is I do think that Alaskans, we have other things to look at that we have to protect Alaskans. And I hope every Alaskan wants to register to vote and participates in the voting process. But I know for a fact there are people that just don't. And I think they should have ample opportunity. So I don't know. I'm not sure what your path forward is on this, Madam Chair. I'm interested to hear how aggressive you are in moving this bill. But right now I have some concerns with it.
Senators, thank you for testifying before Senate Finance today.
Thank you.
I'd like to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 186, State Affairs, /J. Is there anyone wishing to testify here in Juneau, off-net, online? Public hearing is closed. We did not cover a sectional analysis because of the potential violations, both as brought up here at the committee on the violations to the Constitution itself, violations in the current bill to the initiative process that we have. And so we're in a bit of a circle. Senator Bishop, can you cover the fiscal note on this so that this bill is concluded for today? Ms. Race, would you like to join us at the microphone?
Yes, ma'am.
Senator Bishop.
Department of Revenue, Taxation, and Treasury allocation is a permanent fund division. OMB component number is 981. Voter registration, that's the title, and sponsored by the governor. It's a zero fiscal note. I won't even attempt to get into the analyses section.
Thank you, Senator.
As you just aptly described, it's a big circle here right now, so I don't want to.
Well, we'll set the fiscal notes aside, and I'll check that we did not cover them versus covered them. Ms. Race, could you give us any perspective on the CS for Senate Bill 186, that 186 State Affairs /J that came out of committee?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Sarah Race. I'm the Permanent Fund Dividend Division Director. And I would like to note the fiscal note that's currently in there. We do have one that is updated, and it's slightly different. It'll still show a zero fiscal note because we'll be using funds from a capital project to be able to implement the changes that will be required in our system and on the paper application. As far as the CS that was introduced, As a division, we are kind of the information data center that will be passing information, whether it's an opt-in or an opt-out process, in administering the permanent fund dividend. We are going to do our best to make sure that individuals have a clear understanding of whichever way it is, of what is happening.
Questions from committee members? Senator Machicki.
I'll ask it and then I'll strike it. And the question I would ask is how you enjoy being volunteered to become a someone who has suddenly gone from a person who issues PFDs to being an employee of the Division of Elections. You can answer it if you'd like, but I assume that the answer would be very subtle and somewhat milky.
Senator Machicki, Ms. Race will give us a professional response. Ms. Race.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki. The role that the division plays in this, we are trying to help people understand that we are there for the public to answer questions regarding their permanent fund dividend. And all of our messaging that we've put on our website, what we will be putting in the future on our application, and anything that we've communicated through the media, we've really tried to help people understand that if they have questions for the permanent fund, they need to come to us. But if they have questions about voter registration, they still need to go to elections, which can be difficult at times. All of our individuals in our call center, we've definitely directed to make sure that they are still sending individuals to elections, because we want to make sure that they're getting accurate information.
Ms. Reese, how many are there folks who do any opt-out, or do you have any other provisions? I'm trying to think. We have pick, click, and give, so we have high activity under that. We have identifying veterans' benefits. I'm trying to think of all the different activities that are crossing the division's plate and how this is either consistent or not consistent with that work process.
Madam Chair, this is the only option that would be kind of part of the permanent fund dividend application that would be an automatic. Everything else is typically a question that a person is saying yes or no, I do or do not want to participate, whether that I could say that the programs that are a bit outside of what we're looking at eligibility would be the UA College Savings Program, the Pick, Click, Give, and you are correct, the Veteran Program.
Ms. Race, are there people, I know that we had an issue with the richness of the data from the division being accessible to the general public, and that the legislature came in and actually provided an opportunity for people's information on, did we block the entire list from the Permanent Fund Corporation? We did not provide, or did we provide a specific for folks that are afraid or have experienced violence in some way that they don't want their data shown? Was that an overall thing that we did, or was it a segment of the population that we allowed?
Madam Chair, as written in statute, permanent fund dividend information is considered confidential information. The only thing we are allowed to release is the individual's first name and last name. We don't release any additional information besides that. And then we are only able to say yes or no to if an individual has applied or not.
So this creates a quandary in state statute that one group of folks just voted through an initiative process to expose data from those who had originally petitioned the state to protect them. So we had people, I believe I was here for part of that discussion, we had people that came to the state and asked us not to sell that data, that it was putting them in harm's way. Ms. Race, do you remember any of that conversation? Were you?
Madam Chair, I was not part of that conversation. In the past, we have had individuals that have approached the division itself asking kind of similar questions. Again, because we only post the first name and the last name, if you have a very unique name, it is possible that someone could find you. However, you know, we're not releasing any additional identifying information. If you have a bit of a more common name, we might have 8 Sarah Joneses listed. So it would take quite a bit more effort on an individual that is trying to find somebody.
Ms. Race, though, with the initiative process, now all of that data is exposed. Is that accurate?
We do, Madam Chair, provide 7 data elements to elections. So that is the applicant's name and sex, the applicant's Alaska's driver's license or social security number, the applicant's date of birth, the applicant's residence address, and the applicant's, whether they're a U.S. citizen or not, and the date of application, and then the applicant's mark or signature.
Social security number, is that protected? Ms. Race, is the social security number protected in some way as it travels to the Division of Election?
Madam Chair, because all of this information is going through the state security system, yes.
And is it a driver's license or social security number, or does both pieces of information travel?
Madam Chair, I would have to look at the data file to answer that question. I believe right now we are doing one or the other.
Thank you. Senator Michicki.
And Madam Chair, I know you're aware of the time. I just wanted to squeeze in a couple of quick ones here. So, Ms. Race, how many permanent fund dividends were paid last year?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, last year I believe the number was $630,000.
And what? How many of those dividends were mailed out of state?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, I don't have that number off the top of my head, but I'm happy to get it for you.
If I understand the rules, and this is obviously I'll do anything I can to support those that service in the military, but there are some military members that have not lived in the state of Alaska for many, many years. And what are the rules? They have to come back how often and for how long?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, we have several different eligibility requirements, and it kind of depends on how long an individual has been out of the state. It could be 72 hours, or it could be an accumulation of 30 days, kind of depending on their extent out of the state.
Yes.
That would be a time frame, Ms. Race, that they had to return to the state?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Senator Michicki.
So my are we also sending, are we automatically signing people up to be registered voters in the state of Alaska that potentially have been gone from the state for many years due to those eligibility requirements?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, when we were looking at the data and trying to figure out the best way to transfer data to elections, we did focus on individuals that have a physical address in the state of Alaska. So to answer your question, you potentially could have individuals that are still reporting a physical address because maybe they get their mail sent to them, but that was one way that we tried to focus on individuals that are in Alaska.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Reese, are there any challenges for the division in implementing the voter initiative?
Madam Chair, that's a difficult question. It definitely steps us outside of eligibility and focusing on dividends. At this point in time, we've had to work quite a bit with Division of Elections as far as getting a data transfer that is successful. Obviously, our systems are two completely different systems, and so we have definitely spent quite a bit of time trying to work with them to be able to have a successful data transfer. And we really are just trying to follow what was asked of the initiative.
Ms. Race, so what I've heard you say is because the initiative used the word dividend, that we have a group of people that may have applied for a dividend that might be in limbo for a while until we can finalize whether they actually qualify for a dividend. Am I accurately repeating the challenge as far as dividing the work at the division?
Madam Chair, yes, we still have to go through the eligibility process with an individual and determining whether they are eligible to receive a dividend or not. Currently, how the initiative is written, that's not necessarily true for registering them to vote. You could have an individual that's not eligible to receive a dividend, but they have provided all 7 of the data elements, and I'll make sure that comes over to your office in an email. If they've provided all 7 of those elements, at that point in time, we would say they've provided us with the adequate information that Division of Elections needs to be able to move forward with their process, we could still be in the process of determining eligibility for that individual.
Ms. Race, we need to close off this conversation, but did the initiative say receive a dividend, or did it say apply for a dividend, or was it something broader in language? Do you know?
Madam Chair, I believe the initiative said apply for a dividend. It didn't speak to necessarily the eligibility process.
Thank you. Thank you. With that, I would like to hold this bill. Again, if everyone could think about the challenges that are posed, the opportunity is to improve voter turnout. Make it easier for people to register to vote. I'm sure there's a lot of positive things we can say about automatically being registered to vote, but there are some challenges in implementing this and whether we actually have the numbers to pass a state statute that will support the initiative. So that's yet to be seen. I believe we're the second committee of referral on this particular bill. Ms. Race, thank you for joining Senate Finance. This afternoon, Senate Finance will be meeting at 1:30. Should we be off the floor, please, everybody who's watching, we are in the last few days of a 90-day session. Lots going on. The Senate will have House Bill 285 and House Bill 286, appropriation bills for the mental health budget as well as the operating budget. And our bill has a third bill that has the education component. I believe just the operating budget items from mental health and operating budget are before us. But if you recall, there is a third bill that is part of that suite of conversations. With that, the bells are ringing for joint session. We're adjourned.